This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, our final State House candidate interview in this election cycle. We'll talk with Democrat John Fisher. He's running in the 61st District, which includes Portage. But first, we're going to discuss the state of the race with less than 2 weeks to go before Election Day. We're joined by Western Michigan University political science professors John Clark and Peter Wielhauer. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Let's start with this new poll out from the Detroit Free Press. Donald Trump had been down 11 points in Michigan. The new Free Press poll conducted by Epic MRA, Detroit television station WXYZ also sponsored it. And Donald Trump has now polled within 7 points of Hillary Clinton. Is that significant 12 days before the election? John, I'll let you start.
Well, maybe it is, and maybe it isn't. It is if it is an indicator of a trend in the state that the Trump campaign is seeing some advantages. But it may not be. When we look at individual polls, we know that they might be right and they might not be right. We don't know which of those is correct. And so if there's a trend that moves from 11 to 7 and then 3 to plus 1, that's a big deal. But if this poll comes in at 7, the next one comes in at 10. And of course, each pollster has their own way of trying to interpret the data. And so at this point, I'd still rather be her than him, at least in Michigan at this and nationwide, frankly.
Yeah, I would say if we look at the different polls that have been put out over the last month or so, those polls, like the Free Press poll from the first week of October and the Detroit News poll from the following week, they both had substantial Clinton leads. We've seen that narrow somewhat in the polls that have come out over the last 10 days or so, all three of which are showing about a 7 to 8 point Clinton lead. So I think that there is some narrowing going on. But looking at the overall trend, it seems to be a lot of people going back and forth about Trump. Clinton's numbers seem to be fairly stable in all of those polls.
And I think there might be a little bit of what we saw earlier, support for one of the minor party candidates, where folks were not necessarily enamored with the major party choices. We've seen, at least nationally, that the minor party candidates have not been polling quite as strongly. Not that they were especially strong to begin with, but their decline in part has meant that some of that support is probably shifting the major party candidates. And in Michigan, it makes sense that some of that would have shifted to Donald Trump.
Yeah, and in fact, in an MRG poll that came out from last week, we've got 15 to 20% of Michigan respondents saying that they're going to vote for some other candidate or that they're undecided.
One of the factors that we also have to consider here is how much time the campaigns are spending in Michigan. Chelsea Clinton will be in the state, including Battle Creek this weekend, and the vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine also has events planned. If you look at this through the standpoint of Donald Trump's campaign, does it make a lot of sense to even spend a lot of time in Michigan right now? Because it seems as though, you know, his path is pretty narrow. And it doesn't necessarily include Michigan. It really has to include Ohio and Florida. Should that be where he's spending his time the next 12 days?
Oh, I think he definitely needs to go to those states where he's got a much higher shot of winning. You know, looking at Michigan at the beginning of the election cycle, it looked really positive for Hillary Clinton, mainly because it's just not a battleground anymore. Every year we hear Republicans saying, yes, I'm going to go campaign in Michigan. And pretty much by the middle of September, we've seen our last political ad. What's unique about this year over the last few cycles is that the Clinton campaign in particular seems to be more concerned, and they're spending much more time here. I think they're really trying to shore up their base. I don't think they think Michigan's in the bag, but I don't think that there's really that much at risk for them.
I agree with Pete. It's definitely the case at the start of the campaign that Michigan should be one of those states that's in play. It's gone for the Democrats in presidential politics, to be sure, but at the state level, you know, the state executive offices are entirely Republican. And so it's one of those states that either party could win. The reason it becomes less of a battleground closer to the election is that there are other states that are even more competitive than Michigan, and it's those states that the Republican candidates have to do well in. I think the fact that Chelsea Clinton is coming here and not Hillary Clinton means that it's a state that they still are aware of. But it's not the most important state on their map. And the difficulty for the Trump campaign is they simply don't have the same number of high-level surrogates that the Clinton campaign does to send to places like Michigan while the candidate himself or herself is in some other part of the country.
I agree. And another metric that's important is the extent to which the Trump campaign has political offices, campaign offices in lots of these battleground states. And I'm not sure about the numbers in Michigan, but certainly in a lot of other battleground states, there's a huge Clinton advantage just in terms of the sheer organization, having people on the ground for the campaign.
One of the things we heard in the story that NPR filed this morning on the two different campaign rallies in Florida was that Hillary Clinton was talking about the U.S. Senate candidate down there, Patrick Murphy, who's running against Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio did not show up at the Donald Trump rally, and Trump did not mention him by name. Does that maybe reflect more broadly the relationships between the top of each ticket and the candidates who have to run for Senate and then down to U.S. House and maybe even state legislature?
I think absolutely it does. And the fact that Hillary Clinton has been a prominent figure, not just in national politics, but in Democratic Party politics for so long, means that she has relationships with lots of Democrats in lots of places. The fact that Donald Trump came to this election cycle as a complete outsider with virtually no record of relationship with the Republican Party at any level means he doesn't have those kinds of relationships with individual candidates and with state parties. We've seen that in places like Ohio, a state that the Trump campaign desperately needs to win in order to get an Electoral College majority. And he seems to be more concerned there with battles with the state Republicans than he is trying to defeat Hillary Clinton.
And I think part of this also is the long-term pattern that Republicans have of trying to separate their Senate candidates and their House candidates from the top of the ticket. We just see this year after year. If you recall George Bush's campaign in 2004, the tepid support among conservatives for Mitt Romney and for John McCain, they were trying to separate themselves. So it's not a new phenomenon among the Republicans. What I think is really fascinating is all the Democrats now that are strongly petitioning the Hillary Clinton campaign to come campaign for us. I mean, that seems like it's something that I haven't really seen a lot in the last few years.
And we wouldn't have expected that a year ago.
To be sure.
Given her unfavorable ratings and those sort of things,
exactly.
It would not seem like the best strategy, but it seems to have changed
right now.
One interesting thing to note about the Republican dissent about Donald Trump, look here in Michigan, where both Fred Upton and Justin Amash have not endorsed Trump. They didn't have to withdraw an endorsement because they never made one for him. And those are two very different Republican congressmen. Does that say something about Trump's appeal to the voters, but also where he's having trouble with Republican office holders?
I think it does. I think, you know, there are times in each party's history where the inherent fissures within the party are exposed. And political parties, particularly the major parties in the United States, despite changes over the years, are still big tents. And there are lots of people who think of themselves as Republicans and lots of people who think of themselves as Democrats that disagree with other people within their own party, respectively. And I think that there are certain times, and this is one, where we see those fissures exposed. Usually we don't see them until after the election, and then the losing party is where we see those fissures exposed. In this instance, we've actually seen them before the election.
And I think the use of Fred Upton and Justin Amash is a good example of these set of fissures. So in Amash, you have the really strident libertarian ideologues, and certainly Donald Trump isn't anything like that. And you look at Fred Upton, who's a really pragmatic center-right kind of Republican. That's not where Donald Trump is either. So there's not a natural ideological fit for Donald Trump, with most Republicans.
If you look at the state House races around here, there are three which seem to be especially competitive, drawing a lot of attention from both sides. The 61st District in Portage, Republican Brand Eyden being challenged again by Democrat John Fisher, they faced 2 years ago. The 62nd in Battle Creek, where the Republican John Bison's being challenged by the Democrat Jim Hodzma. And then the 66th, which had been held by Eric Nesbitt. He can't run again because of term limits. The Republican Beth Griffin is facing the Democrat Annie Brown. Now, the 62nd was always going to be contested because the Democrats held it before Bison won it in 2014. But these other two races were probably not on the radar necessarily 2 years ago. Did they get there? Can we theorize perhaps because of the Trump effect?
I would say yes. I would say that one of the effects of Donald Trump nationwide is that a lot of state houses and state house seats that could be easily taken for granted by Republicans are now a little bit more in play because you don't have a strong person at the top of the ticket. So what you have with the Democrats this year is a candidate in Hillary Clinton where Democrats are going to be very excited about her. They're going to be able in Michigan to pull that straight party card, filling in that bubble or whatever the mechanism, wherever they are.
Because a federal judge put the state law that would have taken that off the ballot on hold.
Exactly. So we have that. So that's going to benefit Hillary Clinton. What the Republicans are facing is kind of tepid support for Donald Trump. And I think you're going to have fewer Republicans willing to fill in that bubble. And that's going to hurt those down ballot races where people might otherwise not have an awful lot of information about those candidates besides the party label.
I'd say it's a little bit more than just a Trump effect, though, because in many ways it's a presidential election year effect. Certainly in this part of the state, Kalamazoo County in particular, in presidential election years, Democrats do a lot better than they do in non-presidential election years. And that's in part due to the fact that for the last two election cycles, certainly, we've had a successful Democratic presidential candidate. But it's also the case that many of the voters that in this part of the state are less likely to vote every time tend to vote for Democrats, whether it's students at Western or K or KVCC or other folks as well. And so in presidential election years, we see some of this regardless. I think that's accentuated with some of the struggles of the Trump campaign in this part of the state and frankly, in the entire country.
And I think what will be interesting here is what happens to those independents who are the people who are least likely to show up in off years, but tend to vote in higher rates in presidential election years. In Michigan, they tend to be breaking somewhat toward Donald Trump. So that might make a difference in terms of those Republican tickets. But again, they don't have that natural party affinity where they're just going to automatically say, I'm going to fill a straight party ticket for the Republicans.
Just a couple of minutes left. And one thing we should talk about is how far down ballot these effects do ripple. And are there things that candidates can do about that? If you're a state house Republican and normally you think you're in good shape, but now you think that you look in your district and you see maybe some lack of enthusiasm for Trump, maybe see more Hillary Clinton signs than you thought. Is there a strategy there that kind of says, you know, yes, I'm a Republican, but I'm not necessarily a Trump Republican?
So from a campaigning perspective, my advice to any of these candidates would be to stick with what you know. It's the last 2 weeks of the election. No new voters are going to be able to be registered. There's no more time really left for persuasion. You've got to make sure that you get your base out. And that's both Democrats and Republicans. And both of them are going to be focusing on that. That's where they need to focus their energy, on making sure that their high-performance precincts have high voter turnout. That's got to be the key for all of these, because the districts themselves are drawn for partisan advantage. You've got Republican districts and Democratic districts. If they maintain normal party performance, the incumbent, the dominant party within that district should be okay.
And it is really all about turnout. And so even if there are likely Republican voters who aren't completely enamored with Donald Trump, if they're still likely Republican voters and I'm a Republican candidate, I want them to show up on Election Day.
Yes.
And so my job as a candidate and the role of my campaign is to get those people mobilized and to work with the party apparatus and other candidates to make sure that our folks, all of them, are showing up on Election Day. That's going to do, the most that we can do to be successful.
I think what hurts the Republicans this year is that nobody wants to be with the largest, the most prominent Republican in the state, Rick Snyder. For all kinds of reasons, he's not being deployed at all, and nobody wants to be around him because there's all kinds of negative news about him this year, particularly with the handling of the Flint water crisis.
That's a good point. In many ways, that may be at least as strong as the Trump effect in this part of the state.
Okay, I'll give you both about 20 seconds here before we wrap up. What is something that could happen in these last 12 days that you think could shift the race in a way that is more favorable to Donald Trump, where he takes Michigan and maybe wins enough electoral votes to be elected president?
That's a good question. and I'm sure that there are folks at Trump headquarters scratching their heads and trying to figure out what that might look like. If there were to be that kind of trend in Michigan, we would probably see it nationally. And so, again, Michigan may not be the decider under those circumstances. We might see a shift in the Trump direction almost everywhere, which would mean a number of states that are currently competitive would end up in his column.
I think given the steady barrage of bad news and negative publicity that Hillary Clinton's getting nationally, with very little movement in terms of her standing in the polls, I just don't see any scenario where that happens.
And frankly, the same thing is true on the Trump side. We just haven't seen as much change as we might have expected.
All right, gentlemen, we'll leave it there. We'll reconvene in a couple weeks. Western Michigan University political science professors John Clark and Peter Wielhauer will join us again after the election on November 10th. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. 2 years ago, Democrat John Fisher ran for state house in the 61st district. Fisher is again the Democratic candidate challenging Brant Eyden, his Republican opponent 2 years ago, to represent Portage, part of Vicksburg, as well as Oshtemo, Prairie Ron, Texas, and Schoolcraft Townships. John Fisher, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Gordon.
Reintroduce yourself to the audience.
Thank you. I'm the Reverend John Fisher. I'm the pastor at the Oshtemo United Methodist Church, which to me means I have a deep heart for service, and I'm convinced we need more of us in Lansing that go there to serve people and not themselves. Also, I have the privilege, I'm living in the house in Portage where I was born and raised. I took a step down to come back to Kalamazoo so I could take care of my mom while she was dying, and now I have the house to live in. And that points out to me that I'm seeking to represent my home district. Born and raised, always responsible in Portage, I've served the churches in Schoolcraft and Prairie Round, used to deliver grain and got my hair cut at Dee's Barbershop in Vicksburg. I now serve the church in Oshtemo. All of that means I have a deep, intimate knowledge. And again, I think we need representatives that know their district well.
So if you are elected to the state house, what would you like to accomplish there?
First, I'm going to make sure the people of my district are well represented. I've been out knocking on doors. It's one of the best parts is spending times. I've knocked on hundreds of doors every week and meeting people in their homes allows you an opportunity to see the fullness of their lives. Beyond that, I've got a wonderful four-point jobs plan, which I think is very important. The first point of that jobs plan is Michigan money should stay in Michigan. When Michigan is letting out contracts, we need to see to it that Michigan corporations are given first shot and given some preferential treatment. I think it's appalling that, for instance, when we started the newest campaign for Pure Michigan, money went to Ohio. It's ironic that we would be paying Ohio workers with Michigan money.
How much preferential treatment do you give, though? I mean, how do you weight that? Because somebody from Ohio may can't come in at a much lower price, and you may think that the work that they would do is comparable.
That will be the big part of the debate, won't it, as to how heavy to lean onto those scales? Because there's a trade-off. You may save a little money here, but you're spending more because you're shipping money out of state, and the money you would have spent here would keep our economy going as opposed to Ohio's economy. And I don't yet have the full wisdom on that. That's why we have a legislature. There'll be other people there that'll know how best to balance that.
So what else would you like to do to create jobs?
The next one would be hold corporations responsible. When we give tax breaks and various incentives to corporations and they promise to create jobs, if they don't create those jobs, they need to repay that money. And if they ship those jobs out of state or even out of country, then I think they need to repay that money plus some kind of penalty.
Is there any statute of limitations on that? In other words, if you create X number of jobs and then 5 years later, the changes in the economy, et cetera, do they still have to pay back that tax break?
And again, those details are ones that need to be worked out. And there has to be some window. I mean, what do you do when a corporation just disappears?
Or when
Upjohns becomes Pfizer? There are trade-offs, but you saw that. The city of Kalamazoo did well. They gave tax breaks to the Gazette for their new building. Then they chose not to use it, and they had to pay the money back.
And you said it's a four-point plan, so a couple more.
Right. The next one is around education. We need to make sure that everybody is educated and trained, not just for the jobs of today, but the jobs of tomorrow. That means fully funding our public education system. Also, looking at what we do with universities. When my generation went to Western here, the state paid for 70% of the cost and tuition covered 30%. Now that figure is absolutely reversed. We need to reinvest in that, but not everybody needs to go to college. There are trade schools, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Unions apprenticeship training program is right here in Kalamazoo, and it is Kalamazoo Promise eligible. We need to train our skilled labor force. We need to help support things like the programs at KVCC. My youngest son was in their drafting program, and it's outstanding and leads to good jobs. We need to train people for those jobs that will help to improve their livelihood. And we need to get the legislature out of the education of our young people.
So you're talking about fully funding public education. It sounds like you want to boost the state appropriation for higher education and also offer some support for trade schools as well. So how are you paying for that?
It's always the issue, isn't it? And there are several proposals. One that I like is the two-tier system. We've seen that work in Minnesota, where the people who benefit the most from our economy pay their fair share in support of the things that bring them their income, that help to support the endeavors that are helping them to have their income. So we look at how do we see to it that we make the tax fair so that everybody is paying a fair portion of what of their income and what they're earning to support the things that keep the state thriving.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans speaking with John Fisher. He's the Democratic candidate for State House in the 61st District, which includes the city of Portage. If you were in the legislature, would you propose any new regulations on guns in the state? And if so, what would they be?
That's one of those wonderful hot topic issues, isn't it? What do we do about guns? I grew up with guns all around the house. I was a member of the Kalamazoo Rod and Gun Club. We had a shooting competition each week. I even had a trap in the basement we used to practice at home. So I know both the utility and the joy of gun ownership and firing of guns. And we have a gun violence problem. So we need to find ways that recognize the truth of the Second Amendment while having an honest discussion about how do we end gun violence. We have some proven steps, you know, full or complete background checks. But beyond that, we need to have an ongoing open discussion with each other about what makes us safe, how do we curb gun violence. And we did this a few years ago. When I was growing up, my generation was never going to wear a seatbelt. We didn't want to be trapped in a car in an accident. We were going to get out. We were never going to wear a seatbelt. Now we even buckle our children and our grandchildren up into car seats and think it's foolish not to. The same may be true about, is our home safer with a loaded handgun readily available, or is it not safer? We need to have that conversation.
So that sounds like more of a public education effort to convince people that a loaded handgun in the house, you can show the statistics that say, if anything, it's more likely to lead to perhaps the gun being taken away if someone breaks in. It's more likely to do an accidental shooting. It may lead to if someone goes through a time of depression, suicide. Is that what you're talking about?
I think that's what it may bear out. But right now, we don't know. And we have to open the curtain and allow that discussion to occur. We weren't even allowed to track statistics for a number of years. Now we can start talking about the statistics and have an honest discussion that says, I don't want to take your gun away. I want to see how we make it safe.
Would you support reforming Michigan's auto insurance system?
I think we need to look at it slowly and carefully. It has worked well. I've had a number of parishioners who absolutely depend upon having that lifetime care. And I know a number of people are paying too much. the things that we need to look at is the transparency of the commission that sets the rate for uninsured motorists and the catastrophic injuries. We need to open that up so we can see what it really needs to look like and if there's any savings to be found there.
Do you think there could be a link between the lifetime care offered in Michigan, which is not offered in any other state, for someone seriously injured in an accident, and the fact that the auto insurance rates in Michigan are considered among the highest in the country?
Yes, there quite likely is a link, but that's where we got to look at how those rates are being set.
Well, in your mind, is that a price, though, that we should be willing to pay? We should be willing to have higher auto insurance rates so that people like the parishioners in your church who need lifetime care are able to get it.
Right now, yes.
This is considered to be one of the most expensive races for state house in Michigan this year. Should people be concerned about the role of money in politics and in policy, especially in this race?
Yes. Yes, they should. It changes the function of the candidate and of the representative when it absorbs so much time just raising money that they aren't able to fully function as taking care of their constituents or meeting the people they need to meet with, the people they want to represent. Now, the next part of that is we absolutely need to eliminate the dark money by at least letting it be seen. I heard a ad that was attacking me on WKZO radio the other day, and it was paid for by Michigan First, which sounded pretty nice. And when you find it, Michigan First is incorporated in Alexandria, Virginia. And if you look to who gave the money for that, none of the donors are listed, but they did have to list the treasurer. And the treasurer is Theodore Koch. So
related to Charles and David, presumably?
I spelled correctly.
K-O-C-H.
Yeah, that type of thing needs to at least to have the light of day. It's unfortunate that since the Supreme Court decided that money equaled free speech, that money then controls the dialogue. For instance, from 2004 until 2013, my sermon on Labor Day always included the illustration of Apple Corporation, which was sitting on a mountain of cash at the time. And it went from a few hundred million to now maybe $100 billion. And there were thousands of articles written about what Apple could do with that cash, invest in this new endeavor, buy that company. And it wasn't until 2013 that there was one article written suggesting they could pay their workers more. That's how money controls the conversation.
So 2 years ago, you got 42% of the vote, and now you are facing Brant Eyden as an incumbent representative. So why might this year be different than 2 years ago?
The first best thing that changed this year is a twofold thing. We have a much stronger ground game. I have a wonderful staff and group of volunteers. We've knocked on over 30,000 doors thus far and made over 5,000 phone calls. We are really working hard to represent the people of my home district. Second, Representative Eyden has upset enough of the local Republicans that a former Republican mayor, Betty Lee Onley, is campaigning loudly and strongly for me, which I think shows that the people recognize that my opponent lacks judgment and too often has put profits above people. And hopefully that message will sell and we'll get there.
John Fisher, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
John Fisher is the Democratic candidate for State House in the 61st District. That includes Portage, part of Vicksburg, as well as Oshtemo, Prairie Ronde, Texas, and Schoolcraft Townships. A link to the interview with Fisher's opponent, Republican Representative Brant Eyden, can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.